Well, the latest Democrat theory to explain Hillary Clinton's defeat in the presidential election is that Russia somehow took actions to help Trump. Now, even if that were true, that is not why Clinton lost. She lost because enough Americans saw through her corruption and incompetence. If Russia did hack into emails to help Trump, they had the ability to hack into Clinton's emails, which were far less secure. And yet we are told that Clinton's emails were not hacked. Now, I have no problem with examining whether or not Russia, China, or North Korea hacked into computers in America. After all, America is hacking into their computers. When Bibi Netanyahu was up for election, re-election in Israel, Obama pulled out all stops to interfere with Israel's election. Now, it's time to stop the nonsense. Here's what we need to do. Investigate the dead people voting. Investigate illegal immigrants voting or people voting several times in multiple states. That's where the major fraud is being committed. Now, we should be concerned about the outcry because somebody, Russia or otherwise, exposed the corruption in the Clinton campaign. Not jumping on an outsider for exposing it. Hacking is worldwide. We do it. They do it. It's detestable, but it's a fact. Frankly, I want to know about corruption among Democrats or Republicans, and I do not have a problem with how they find out about it. Now, please listen carefully today as I explain who ISIS is, how they came to be, and where their financing comes from. A lot of research went into today's commentary, and it's my hope that I've been able to make the danger that confronts us a little more easily understood. I'll get to all of that shortly, but first, I continue to be disappointed in our two political parties, Democrats and Republicans. I'm also disappointed at Americans who will simply not listen to the truth about those parties. We are more divided today than at any time in our history, and there are those among us who are too hard-headed to realize the danger of that division. The division between the races is one thing, but this election showed Hillary Clinton attempting to divide the sexes as well. She wanted their vote because she was a woman. Some fell for it, but enough women voted their conscience rather than their gender to stop the corrupt Clinton machine. Now comes the attacks against those who have succeeded and grown rich in America. Isn't it the American dream to be successful? And with that success comes the rewards. I hear people complaining that Donald Trump is putting millionaires into his cabinet. Well, those people are not millionaires because they are stupid. They're millionaires because they are smart. So what's the alternative? Putting poor people in the cabinet? God bless them. I've been poor, and there is nothing wrong with being poor. But those who are poor for a reason. Few among the poor are well-educated. Few among the poor have the difference to manage to manage a cabinet position in our government. To assume that just because someone has made a success of themselves and become wealthy means that they cannot recognize the needs of the poor and middle class, nor have the moral character to care about them, is ridiculous. It is not true that all of Trump's cabinet appointees are millionaires. The military generals, for instance, are not millionaires. Ben Carson is not among the wealthiest Americans, and what money he has made is due to his intellect and surgical skills. That entire argument is bogus and spiteful. Presidents who were not millionaires, like Barack Obama, become millionaires very quickly once in power. Does the fact that Obama's financial worth is now in the millions of dollars mean that he suddenly can't identify with the poor? The truth is that the poor and middle class in America will remember this year as the year that the middle class became a marginalized minority, taken advantage of by Washington, insurance companies, big bucks, the banks, vultures on Wall Street, and the Federal Reserve. America's stagnant wage earners have not enjoyed much this year. As a new study from Pew Research shows, they now make up only 49% of U.S. households. There's been very little spare change in this year's paychecks, as Jonathan Trugman of the New York Post points out, and lots of rising out-of-pocket costs. Let's start with Obamacare. This year saw the average Obamacare premium skyrocket again. Based on healthcare.gov figures, the cost of the benchmark plan across all 37 states that used the federal exchange in 2015 saw a 7.5% rise in premiums. And in 2016, that percentage has skyrocketed upwards. No matter how you slice it, there never has been one year in which the average family of four saved the $2,500 that Obama and the Democrats promised them. Nor has there been a single year in which the average middle-class family of four saved a single dollar on premiums. Worse still, deductibles have become almost impossible for the average wage earner to afford. The average deductible has gone from $900 in 2010 to $1,300 in 2015 and will have risen even more by the end of 2016. Some see deductibles as high as $6,000 to $8,000. Even the Federal Reserve, which along with the Treasury Department helped line the pockets of big banks via the dual profit infusion of the Troubled Asset Relief Program and quantitative easing, is taking a swipe at the middle class. Raising rates disproportionately affects the cost of capital to consumers and the middle class big companies. These big companies have already billions in cheap, long-term bonds, something they have not afforded to the middle class. The bumping up of the interest rate hits the middle class right on the chin. And everything from credit cards to car loans to home equity loans of credit are affected. Sure, we're saving a few bucks on gas at $2 a gallon, but year after year, America's middle class continues in a downward spiral, which changes the country for the worst. We have to turn this country back from Obama's fundamental changes. It is so disappointing to hear liberals make excuses for incompetence and corruption. When I was a young boy, I used to daydream about escaping the poverty of our family. I had to find a way, but finding the way is difficult. I understood poor people then because I was one of them. I was not taught to demean nor hate rich people. On the contrary, our parents taught us to have respect for the rich and the poor, the black and the white. Through hard work, education, and perseverance, I realized my dreams. Reaching millionaire status did not mean that I could no longer understand the poor and the middle-class families struggling to make ends meet. On the contrary, it has allowed me to speak up for those who are trying their very best and not reaching their dreams. And by the way, those millionaires that Trump is talking about and proposing for his cabinet, they're not going to take a salary. They're going to take $1. The majority, being rich by rich standards, does not mean that those successes should be penalized or that they should not be appointed to cabinet positions. The Obamas spent some $85 million on luxury vacations in just 8 years of office. That's more than a million a year. Barack Obama drew a salary of $400,000 from taxpayers. Because he is a billionaire, Trump does not need to rip off the taxpayers with numerous lavish vacations. He declines to take the $400 presidential salary that Obama could afford to do, but chose not to decline. My point is that how much money a person is worth should not be a yardstick in measuring their character or ability to get things done. The losing party in the November 8 election can choose to gripe and undermine the presidency of Trump, or they can value the country well enough to get on board the Trump train. We'll know soon enough whether Trump is up to the job. To protest something that has not even yet happened is idiotic. to disrupt the presidential inauguration is un-American, whether that president is a Democrat or a Republican. We are all in this boat together. To stand up in the boat and capsize it risks us all. The election is history. The future is before us. You and I can either help the country succeed, or we can try to gum up the works. You decide which side you want to be on. Now, 5 years ago, the Islamic State ISIS did not even exist. Now it controls vast swaths of Syria and Iraq. ISIS is today an entity with domestic command. They've got domestic control, propaganda, and logistical capabilities, and one that has proven its ability to take and hold strategically critical territory at the heart of the Middle East. ISIS is the product of a genocide that continued unabated as the world stood by and watched it. The policies of Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton saw them ignore the warnings from our military that pulling our troops out unilaterally would create a vacuum that ISIS would move in to fill. Nevertheless, Obama set a timeline to yank the troops out, and ISIS simply waited until they saw the taillights of our convoys leaving town before they swept in and began to grow. ISIS is the illegitimate child born of hate and fear, the result of 300,000 murdered Syrians and millions more displaced and divorced from their hopes and dreams. ISIS is also a reminder of how Bashar al-Assad, his embrace of al-Qaeda would come back to haunt him. Facing Assad's army and intelligence services, Lebanon's Hezbollah, Iraq's Shia Islamic militants, and their grand patron, Iran's Revolutionary Guards, Syria's initially peaceful protesters quickly became disenchanted, disillusioned, and disenfranchised, and then radicalized and violently militant. The Shia Islamic Axis used chemical weapons, artillery, and barrel bombs to preserve its area of influence. Syria's Sunni Arab revolutionaries, in turn, sought international assistance, and when the world refused, they embraced a pact with the devil, Al-Qaeda. With its fiercely loyal army of transnational jihadists, Al-Qaeda once again had gained a foothold in the heart of the Middle East. Fueled by the hate and fear engendered by images of dismembered children or women suffering from the effects of chemical weapons, disaffected youth from around the world rushed to Syria, fueling an ever more violent race to the bottom. ISIS members want an Islamic state or caliphate run according to Islamic Sharia law. A caliphate is an Islamic state. It's led by a caliph, a person considered to be a political and religious successor to Islamic prophet Muhammad. Throughout history, there have been 8 caliphates. ISIS believes that it is a legitimate state right now, rather than a group of terrorists. It wants recognition by the rest of the world and for all Muslims to recognize their radical view of Islam. ISIS is committed to purifying the world by killing vast numbers of people. The lack of objective reporting from ISIS territory makes it truly extent of the slaughter unknowable. But social media posts from the region suggest that individual executions happen daily, and mass executions happen every few weeks. Muslim apostates are the most common victims. An apostate is somebody considered to have abandoned the Islamic faith, a political party, or one's principles. The Islamic State's extreme beliefs stem from an obsessive adherence and controversial interpretation of religious texts. Sharia is Islam's legal system. It's based on teachings from the Quran and the Prophet Muhammad. While Western law covers only crime, legal disputes, and individual rights and freedoms, Sharia law also covers aspects of personal life. For example, Sharia even covers the correct course of action if you're invited out for dinner with friends. ISIS believes that Sharia law should be above the laws of other countries. The group imposes it immediately on territory that it captures. ISIS believes a prophecy from the Prophet Muhammad means the end of the world is coming. The 1,300-year-old prophecy says the Day of Judgment will come after an epic battle between Christians and Muslims. The prophecy says that battle will come at Babing, a town close to the Syrian border with Turkey. The year of that battle is pegged at 2076. Although the town of Dabig is not an important military target, we can see why now ISIS worked so hard to take control of it. Ironically, al-Qaeda's wholesale introduction into Iraq came at the hands of the Assad regime in Syria. From 2005 until the end of the American occupation of Iraq, Assad's military intelligence services and their Iranian backers sought to defeat U.S. forces by training, financing, and arming al-Qaeda operatives inside Syria and dispatching them across the Iraq border to cause chaos and destruction. General David Petraeus and other senior American officials warned Assad that he was igniting a fire that would eventually burn his house down. And so Syria's unraveling spilled into Iraq and vice versa. Powerful regional tribes, faced with countless dead and persecuted members in both countries, banded together with former Iraqi and Syrian military officers, embracing ISIS's jihadis as their frontline shock troops. Cash poured in from sympathetic donors around the region. Iraq's four Sunni Arab provinces fell under the control of ISIS within days. Entire Iraqi army divisions just evaporated, and hundreds of millions of dollars worth of advanced military equipment from the United States was seized by ISIS and its allies. Fueled by what was increasingly a regional Sunni-Shia proxy war, Iraq and Syria had become incubators for international jihad and religious hate. As world leaders now consider a military campaign to confront ISIS, they should remember the lessons of America's costly and largely fruitless engagements in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Vietnam. They should understand that no amount of foreign military power can ever make up for the misrule of corrupt, failed governments like those in Damascus, Baghdad, Kabul, or Saigon. Unless they want a regional holy war, they should especially discount the advice of some who are now calling for an alliance with Assad's genocidal regime, perhaps the single greatest root cause of the rise of ISIS. Instead, they should embrace the lessons of Iraq's Sunni tribal awakening, that only Syrian and Iraqi Sunnis can defeat radical militant Sunni entities like ISIS. Likewise, they should understand that only the mullahs in Iran can help quell the radical militant Shia entities like Lebanon's Hezbollah, Assad's intelligence operatives, or Iraq's militias. There exists in the United States a significant jihadi movement led primarily by the Muslim Brotherhood, whose organizers include the most prominent and influential Islamic groups in America. The Islamic movement in the United States continues their daily work of preparing for the coming battle at all levels of our society. From a military standpoint, the leaders of radical Muslim communities are coalescing their forces and preparing strategically, operationally, and logistically for war. Make no mistake, the election of Donald Trump as incoming president was a massive blow against radical Islam in America. Thanks to Barack Obama, the Muslim Brotherhood saw its members brought into the Obama administration and into sensitive positions that threatened the security of our country. Going back to the early 1980s, the jihadis set up an elaborate network of jihadi centers, known in the United States as the Al-Kifa Refugee Centers. there to recruit jihadis for the war against the Soviets in Afghanistan. Some of these over three dozen offices were operated by only a couple of jihadis with a phone and fax machine, and some had a more sizable presence in the community. For the last few decades, the Pakistani terrorist organization known as Jamaat al-Fugra has been establishing jihadi training camps in the United States, primarily among black Muslims, many of whom are recruited and radicalized in prison. Known in the United States as Muslims of America, or MOA, approximately two dozen of the three dozen known camps appear to be operational even today. In the early 1900s, the chief investigator for the state of Colorado, with support from the governor and attorney general, launched a raid of an MOA compound in near Buena Vista, Colorado. And there they discovered weapons, explosives, lists of people to be assassinated, and evidence that military bases had been under surveillance. A 2004 FBI raid in Annandale, Virginia, home of a senior Muslim Brotherhood Hamas leader, they found a recording of a senior Muslim Brotherhood leader speaking to a group of Muslim brothers in Missouri and revealed the Brotherhood has numerous training camps inside America and conducted regular firearms training. In the Muslim Brotherhood's five-phase World Underground movement, discovered at that 2004 FBI raid in Annandale, Virginia, the Brotherhood states that they must establish a secret government within our government. The purpose is to have jihadis on the inside of our government who will serve as the leadership of the Islamic movement when they seize power in the United States. The most prominent Islamic organizations in the United States are a part of a massive jihadi network whose stated objective is to wage civilian jihad to destroy our system of government and establish an Islamic state, a caliphate, under Sharia here. Evidence shows that the Muslim Brotherhood's Islamic centers, their mosques, are places in which jihadis train for battle and from which the jihad will be launched. All of the mosques, all of them that our military entered during the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, are mosques that European authorities have raided in the past 2 years, and all had weapons in them. The weaponry is what Muhammad used a mosque for, and the launch point for jihad is one of those purposes. There are 2,400 Islamic centers or mosques in America, most of which are part of the Muslim Brotherhood's jihadi network. In the United States, the nucleus for the Islamic movement is the Islamic Society of North America, or ISNA, whose subsidiary Islamic societies number approximately 170. The Muslim Students Association serve as a recruiting arm for jihadis, and there are over 700 chapters on nearly every major college campus in America. Mosques and Islamic organizations are being built in strategic locations near key infrastructure facilities, military bases, and other key positions in our communities. Taxicab drivers at America's largest airports are Muslim, and there is a noticeable increase in Sharia-compliant Muslim TSA officials, baggage handlers, and airline airport employees at the United States airports. With Al-Qaeda, as evidenced by the discovery of a CARE document dated March 8, 2004 at their headquarters in Washington, D.C., it stated, quote, "The attempt is to understand Islamic movements in your area and start supporting Islamic groups, including Mr. bin Laden and his associates." Now, the United States government is bringing in tens of thousands of Sharia-adherent Muslims into our country. From the Islamic perspective, these people are muhajirun, those who make the move into non-Muslim lands in preparation for the final stage, which is armed conflict with the host country. It's all part of the Islamic doctrine. Each year, there are between 70 and 120 new Islamic nonprofits being created in America. which most of them appear to be working directly with the Muslim Brotherhood's plan to wage civilian jihad until the zero hour comes and the war begins. Until then, they continue to prep the battlefield, because they are at war with us and have told us so, and because they are following Sharia, a core Islamic doctrine, as their blueprint for what they plan to accomplish. Neither Barack Obama nor other officials in his administration have spoken of shutting down radical mosques in the United States. But U.S. hesitation about taking action that are now being implemented in France and Belgium isn't for a lack of mosques in this country, in which hatred for American values and support for jihadi terrorism are routinely heard. There are more than 80 radical mosques in the United States. These mosques and their leading clerics have radicalized attendees to become terrorists. They've supported terrorist organizations, made radical Islamic remarks, or hosted others who have or are financially backed by radical individuals or organizations. Make no mistake, radical Islam is not confined to a ragtag group of terrorists who are killing innocent people in the Middle East. It is here, among us, and it's growing daily. It is a cancer that will ultimately destroy us if it is left untreated. If we allow the cancer of radical Islamic forces already inside our borders to continue to metastasize, and if we continue to drop our guard against forces who have publicly stated their intent to destroy us to continue unabated, we will have no one to blame for our downfall but ourselves. With freedom comes responsibility, and those who are irresponsible do not deserve to be a part of America's freedom. The greatest danger to America today is radical Islam, something that Obama and liberal Democrats refuse to even acknowledge. We should thank God for this one last opportunity to turn America around, to restore morality, truth, and justice for everybody. Let us pray that the Trump administration will put America first, that it will abandon the naive and dangerous policies of Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, and that America will become great again.